My name is Carrie. I am the student pastor here at Root & Branch this year. It's good to see everyone. As Neil said, there's so many new or almost new faces, and it's really good to see you all. We have been working our way through a sermon series on Christian vocabulary words and thinking about some of these words that have been around for a long time, but thinking about ways that we can reclaim them and find new ways to incorporate them into our own lives. So I was thinking about what word I wanted to talk about tonight, and I decided that it might actually be fun to pick a word that I had no desire to talk about and kind of encounter that challenge with all of you guys. So I picked sin. And I don't know if I've ever actually heard a sermon on sin that I liked, so we're gonna try it and see what happens. And I think that for me, sin is one of those words that Christians throw around, like the word saved, where it's assumed that like everyone's talking about the same thing and we all know what we're talking about. But the thing that drives me crazy is this idea that if you were to like line up several Christians and say, what does sin mean to you? First of all, I bet you that everyone would not agree on what acts are considered sins. And secondly, I bet they might point you to a Bible verse or two, and then we could go to those Bible verses and see that even the Bible doesn't agree on exactly what sin means or what sin is. And so just to kind of give you an idea of that, I wanted to talk about a few ways first in which sin is used in the Bible. And it comes into play pretty early on in the first page or two with Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit. And so I'm going to go ahead and ask my readers, Caroline, could you start us off with the second reading actually? Oh, nope, the bottom part of the first one, of the second one, I'm sorry.
Yes, for we have tasted evil, succulent and sweet, and passed it on for others to lick and taste and eat.
Thank you. And then, Yoon, will you please read our second our first reading, which is
first
now our
reading
second reading?
From Psalm 51, 1 through 3. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me.
Thank you. Now I want to point out in the book of Psalms, like that psalm that Yoon just read, sin is thought of as this stain or this mark that gets on a person and that needs to be washed off. But in the book of Leviticus, that's also in the Bible, there's this idea that sin is a burden that a group of people bear. And I was researching this and I actually found out that this idea of a scapegoat actually comes from Leviticus, because the priest would take an animal and lay their hands on it and basically confess the sins of the entire people over this animal, with the idea being that then the burden would be lifted off the people and placed on the animal, and then the animal was sent far into the desert, which was thought to be out of the sight of God, and the sins would be taken from the people and gone with the animal. And so I just thought those were two really interesting and different ways of looking at sin in the Bible. And then when we move further through the Bible, so now we're looking at like the first century AD, so this was around the time that Jesus lived. Sin was no longer thought of as a stain or a mark or a burden, and those terms had fallen out of use in first century Judaism. But instead, it was thought of as a debt to be paid, a debt that was owed to God. And I find that really interesting, because the reason it started being seen as a debt is because the Jewish society had become more economically based, and as the economy changed and there were these new words like debt to describe something that was happening in the more secular realm, that transferred into their religious language. And so that even Jesus, when he was raised as a first century Jew, he used this word debt to talk about sin. So some of us who have recited the Lord's Prayer before, the word that is actually used in the Bible, in the Lord's Prayer, when Jesus is reciting it, is the word for debt. And so what I think is really interesting is that these communities throughout the Bible used metaphors for sin that were heavily related to their own cultural realities. And as their cultures changed, their metaphors for sin changed as well. And I can't help but notice that modern day Christians haven't really followed this example of biblical communities. Because rather than creating metaphors for sin that speak to our own society and our own experience, we've taken these ancient terms and made them our own, even though they're thousands of years old and some of them had already fallen out of use by the time Christianity began. And it's so interesting to me because I grew up as a Christian and all my life I heard people say things like, lay your burden at the foot of the cross, or the blood of Jesus will wash away your sins, or forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And even secular culture has jumped on this bandwagon. And I wonder how many of us have ever heard someone ask a question, especially lately, like about why a politician can't keep his hands clean. And all of these ideas go back to those ancient ideas of sin and the ways that sin was used differently in the Bible. And the more I think through those different biblical metaphors for sin, the more disconnected I feel from them and the less I feel that they actually speak to my reality as a modern day Christian. Because when I do something wrong, I'm much more interested in the ways that my words or actions have impacted a relationship than I am in having some sort of invisible mark removed from me. I'm more concerned about restoring that relationship through apologizing or trying to do better the next time than I am in some sort of cosmic transaction. But I'm also not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater and to say that thinking about sin doesn't matter, because I actually think it matters a lot. We live in a world where people hurt each other and people hurt themselves and people feel chronically alone and unloved. There is a very real sense that things are not as they should be. And I think it's really important for us to sit with that reality, resisting the desire to fix it or numb it or ignore it before we've really even named it. Sin pervades our lives and the lives of people that we love, and we need a better metaphor that will help us to think and talk about it. And so I'd like to offer a metaphor that I find really compelling, and I'm interested to hear in our conversation later what you all think about it. And it's a metaphor that seeks to describe sin in a way that relies less on these ancient cultural norms and more on our contemporary lived experience. And it's an idea that was coined by a 20th century theologian named Paul Tillich. In his Systematic Theology, Tillich described God as the ground of being. And he believed that God is both the source as well as the reality in which our lives are grounded. And so sin, for Tillich, is a state of estrangement or separation from that source and that ground of our own being. And he suggests that from the moment a person is born, they're born into a state of estrangement and of separation from other people, from their own selves, and from God as the ground of their being. He believes that it's this experience of separation that is inherent to the human condition, and that the experience of sin for all of us has an element of both fate and guilt. We are born into it, and we also perpetuate it. I want to stop there for a minute and take a moment to parse out that idea of sin having a dynamic of fate and guilt, because I think both are a really critical piece of forming this new metaphor and of having a holistic idea of what sin is and how it affects us. There's this idea in Christian theology known as original sin. And some of you may be familiar with it. It's this concept that when the first human people sinned, which traditionally in Christian mythology is Adam and Eve in the garden, their sin was then inherited by all of humankind, like a mark on the soul. And as the story goes, Adam and Eve were created sinless, but with free will. And because they used that free will to sin, thanks to them, all of the rest of us were born as sinners. or so the theory goes. And I've never actually bought into this idea myself because I really have never been able to get to the point where I believe that a baby is born sinful. And this is why I really like the direction that Tillich goes in, because he nuances this idea of original sin in a way that I think is really helpful and interesting to think about. When Tillich talks about sin as fate, he suggests that it's not that we're born with this taint on our soul, but rather when we're born, we enter into the world that is already filled with broken and hurting people, where separation and estrangement are alive and well. We are fated to inherit sin through nurture rather than through nature. We're raised by and among sinners, and so we are destined to become sinners ourselves. So that's the fate piece. But the guilt part of sin comes through the fact that we have free will. But it's also directly related to this idea of estrangement or separation that we're born into. As a result of our separation from God and ourselves and others, we commit sinful acts. And I think that the best way for us to think about the connection of those things is to map it onto the human experience. And so if we think about, maybe some of us have taken human development courses, if you think about an infant, a baby, babies believe in their earliest stages that they and their mother are the same being, that they are the same person. And they have no sense of separation between the two people. However, we were all there, and then we all started to grow up. And as we neared the toddler stage, when we were about 2, clearly things had changed because we start saying no a lot. We start asserting ourselves. We start developing our own personality and this realization that we and our mothers are not the same person. And so this development continues, and we continue to develop this idea of the independent self. And for most of us, it probably came to a head when we were teenagers. As we started to really dig deep and figure out who am I and what's going on and what does it mean to be a person, and really trying to assert our own independence. But it was also during those teenage years that we probably started longing, on the flip side, for intimacy with other people. So as we're trying to figure out who we are and how to assert ourselves in the world, we're also wanting to make these intimate connections with other human beings. Because as hard as we've tried to separate and define ourselves, the reality of that separation still pains us. And so we seek to be united with other independent selves. Through seeking intimacy with one another, we rage against our estrangement. But no matter how much work we put into knowing and loving each other, we're never quite able to find our way back to that moment in infancy when we believe that we were truly one person with another person. It's always just beyond our reach. We're always separate and somewhat estranged from one another. And in the midst of that experience of estrangement, in the midst of the reality we've inherited, in which we cannot achieve literal oneness with another person, we exercise our free will in ways that hurt each other. We hurt each other when our expectations are not met, when our wildest romantic or platonic fantasies fail to play out and to overcome our experiences of estrangement once and for all. We hurt. And so we sin. And the same thing happens with our interaction with God or with the divine. We try to figure this whole religion or spirituality thing out. We ask big questions, we dig deep, we use the minds that we've been given. But we are forever and always left with this silence, this wondering, this mystery, this hope, and this doubt. Because even if God is, in fact, the ground of our being, we are most certainly estranged from it. And in our frustration and our anger at the silence or the absence of the divine in our lives, we shut down. We give up. We lash out. We hurt and we sin. And what about our experience of ourselves? I want to pose two questions for you to just think about silently for a minute. The first is, who are you? And the second question is, how do you feel about yourself? Take a minute to just think about those things. Who are you, and how do you feel about yourself? Did anyone have trouble coming up with an answer to one or both of those questions? Can I see a show of hands? Were any of those difficult questions to answer? I think it's really interesting because we spend our entire existence with ourselves, and yet it's pretty much impossible for us to appropriately define and completely love ourselves. We spend our lives estranged from our own personal center, from the reality that is us alone. And so we abuse our bodies and our hearts and our minds. We hurt, and so we sin. The pain that inevitably results from our experience of estrangement tempts us to sin, and we often do. And this is our guilt. Sin rising out of estrangement. It's a good metaphor. But if we're born into a sinful world and destined to become sinners ourselves, where's the hope in that? The Christian tradition suggests that the hope for sinners is through this idea of grace, which we've talked about here before. And Tillich explains that sin and grace are forever bound to one another. He writes that we do not even have a knowledge of sin unless we already have experienced the unity of life, which is grace. In just a minute, we're going to split up and discuss all of these things in small groups together. But before we do that, I wanted to take a minute to share a personal story in the hopes that we can kind of put skin on these ideas of sin and estrangement and grace and how those things all work together. A few weeks ago, I was at the end of one of my semesters, and I was in the middle of finals, and I was feeling really stressed. And when I get really stressed, my feeling of estrangement increases significantly. And at this particular time, and this is pretty normal for me, when I get stressed and I have anxiety, I become very singularly focused on the task at hand. And I lose sight of the people, the friends and the colleagues and whoever else is in my life at that time. And I remember that week, I said some things I regretted to people that I care about. And the guilt and the shame that I felt at my own inability to manage my anxiety well and to be patient and kind only added to my own frustration and feelings of estrangement between myself and others. So one day in the midst of all this, I decided to take a walk to the lake. Because that walk always helps me to center myself, and there's something about seeing the horizon across that body of water that just really helps me to put things in perspective when I'm stressed or having a hard time. So I left my house, my music was playing, it was a gorgeous day, I was loving the exercise, but there was one unforeseen issue that arose as I'm walking to the lake. Because it was the first gorgeous day of spring, it seemed as if every single mother in Hyde Park was walking around with her infant or her toddler. They were literally everywhere. When I see a mother with her children, I usually love it, and it's really sweet, and I smile, and I'm happy for them. Most of them seem to be having a great time. What was interesting is when I saw them everywhere on my mile walk to the lake, I started feeling really depressed. Because I was reminded of my own years as a foster mother and of all the children I've lost and of the ways that we used to play outside and fly kites and do fun things. And I was just overwhelmed with sadness as I continued to see these mothers and their kids on my walk to the lake. And these thoughts started coming into my head that I usually keep at bay, that I usually don't think about a lot. And my thoughts went something like this. I miss being a mother. What if I never have children again? What if I don't find someone to spend my life with until I'm too old to have kids? What if I don't find someone to spend my life with, period? Why do I suddenly want biological children when I never have? I've always wanted to adopt. What is going on? Why is other people's joy making me so sad? What is wrong with me? Needless to say, by the time I got back to my house, I was ready to get the hell out of the sunshine and bury my face in Netflix and try to forget about everything going on outside of my window. The next day was Sunday, and I was sitting in the Gorilla Tango Theater as the service was getting ready to start, and Kirsten and Jeremy walked in. And for those of you who don't know them, they're a young couple in our congregation, and they have a one-year-old little boy and a two-year-old little girl, and they're not here tonight. But anyway, they walked in, and Kirsten locked eyes with me. I was just sitting there, and she just kind of thrust Vinny, the little boy, into my arms with no explanation, just handed him to me. So I situated him on my lap, and he looked up with me with his very mature eyes. If you've seen him, you know what I'm talking about. And he just looked at me with this expression that was something like, "You're not my mother, but I suppose you'll do." And he just curled up and fell sound asleep. And I have to admit, I had a really hard time paying attention to Tim's sermon that day, which was actually on grace, because all the grace that I needed in that moment was snoring in my arms rather loudly. That hour with Vinny was sacred for me. It was a time in which the estrangement that I had experienced so significantly the day before seemed to fade away. And I felt intimately connected to God and to myself and to that little boy in my arms. I was overwhelmed by this sense that my pain and longing from the day before had somehow been felt and heard and responded to in an absurdly appropriate and tangible way. I felt seen and known and loved in the mystery of it all. And for that hour, at least, grace conquered estrangement. Tim's gonna come up and we're gonna listen to some music, and I'm just gonna leave you with a few questions to think about during the song, and we'll talk about them in small groups afterwards. One is, I wanna know what you think about this idea of sin coming out of our estrangement and how you've experienced that in your own life. And then I also would like to know, what are those little moments of grace for you? What does that look like? Is it music? Is it time with children? Is it being outside? What helps to overcome that experience of estrangement for you in your life?